names in order where they're going to be sitting. First, right over here, Nigel Tufnel. Christopher Guest. David St. Hubbard, Michael McKee. And Derek Small, Harry Shearer.
Interesting to see yourself younger, a lot younger. I think it's, what do you think?
Could you hear everything? And what was happening was, your reactions were sort of concert reactions, which were great, but it was sort of like you'd see a scene beginning, and it was like hearing the beginning of, you know, Freebird. And so you were kind of laughing into it. But I hope you all heard as much as you were going to hear, because it was really fun to be in this house. You guys seemed to dig it. That was great.
I have to say, I was taken back in a time machine when I saw the scene with Paul Schaefer. To the moment when Michael McKean and I and our ex-partner in a comedy group called The Credibility Gap, David L. Lander, were in, thank you, very generously, we're in Arizona doing a gig, and everything that could possibly be fucked up about our technical setup was, and the representative of Warner Brothers Records, a gentleman by the name of Lou Dennis, came backstage, and we were furious. This was a record merchandising convention, and this was a chance for people in the business to become acquainted with an act they didn't care about. And Lou Dennis, before we could say one word to vent our anger, says, "Guys, kick my ass."
Became known as Lou Kick My Ass Dennis.
4 years afterwards, he says, "I'm the guy in that movie.
Kick my ass. Kick my ass." Well, of course, the other problem with that gig was that it was conventioneers, and they started drinking about 9:30 in the morning, and this was like more like 9 p.m. We went on. It got worse. Tucson, Arizona.
Tucson, yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, 35 years later, it's just insane when you think about it. I mean, we were talking before that, you know, they voted this into the National Film Registry, you know, it's part of the Smithsonian. It's just bizarre. It's so strange, because when the first time we screened the film in Dallas, people would come up to us and say, "Why would you make a movie about a band that nobody ever heard of? And one that's so bad, why would you do that?" But, you know, it just took a
Good
while.
Question.
Huh?
Good question.
Yeah. It just took a while. People figured
some of the cards we got from the audiences who saw test screenings were amazing. There was one, I happen to know she was a woman. I'll say she was a woman. It has nothing to do with it. But for the questions like, "What did you like about this film?" she wrote, "DNA." How would you describe this film to others? DNA. We figured out it meant does not apply. He was not on board.
One of the notes said in the screenings, well, first of all, Michael and I in Dallas went to get some popcorn, and there were two young women that came out in the middle of the movie. And one of the girls said to the other one, "These guys are so stupid."
They were right.
Well, they were right, yeah. I think that was the charm of that. But one of the cards said, what did you like about it? And the person wrote it, said, "It's in color."
it is insulting.
It's not a good jumping off point.
No, no, no. And I love that, I forget, Dana Carvey is in it. You can see him, he's got a little mime thing, and there's Billy Crystal, and there's
Fran Drescher,
and Fred Willard, and Howard Hessman, and
And Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg.
By the way, Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg, played by Patrick McNee, the whole film is completely improvised except for the one speech that Patrick McNee says. He does that tap into America. He says, I don't improvise. So we sat down and wrote that little, that's the only written thing in the whole movie.
But to be fair to us, Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg would have written his remarks.
Yes. Really good point, Harry. Thank you.
Always the purest. The thing that always was, what are you looking at? Water. It's just water. But here's what I was
going to do. A lot more than water.
I was going to pour the water into my glass, and it's already full, so that would have been an interesting little premise there. But we had Peter Smoakler was the DP on the film, and we hired him because he had shot lots of rock and roll documentaries, and we thought he would be the perfect guy. He was actually in at Altamont when the very famous Rolling Stones concert with the Hells Angels, a very sad time. But we hired him to shoot it, and it's shot. I mean, he had
H.J. Brown.
H.J. Brown, who was also a great rock and roll photographer, and it shot great and everything. And we're going through this, and he kept saying to me, he says, "I don't understand what's funny about this." I said, "This is exactly what they do."
Now, this was probably a trait that served Peter well, not seeing what was funny about what he was shooting, because we saw, I think all four of us saw, another film that he had made before he came on our project. He had shot a documentary called This Time Is for the Championship. You have not heard of it, clearly. The lack of applause gave you away. There was a gentleman in the 1970s by the name of Werner Erhard who ran an organization called EST, and everybody's agent went to EST. And at some point, with all the free time and money that his customers had given him in those hotel ballrooms over the weekends, Werner Erhard decided to learn how to become a championship auto racer and commissioned a documentary about the process of learning to drive championship cars, and Peter shot it. So it would have been a bad idea for him to say, "You know what, this is the funniest shit I've ever seen."
Yeah. I never heard that story.
Well, it has no ending, so.
I hope I never get
fired. I'm saving it for tonight. No, it was an astonishing film. And very funny, but,
yeah. And we had some interesting things, and we discussed this because we thought there was a life to the band. They had their own life, and they had their own history. We spent a lot of time talking about the characters, so everybody had the frames of reference. You could talk about a particular album or where they were from, so everybody had their own history, and so there was an organic creation of the band. And we had some people come in to audition because, the three, and then we had, we needed a drummer and a keyboard player. And so different people would come in. John Densmore, who was a great drummer for The Doors, he came in, and we all said, "Great, but then he's in The Doors. It's not, it's not this alternative world that we've created." Paul Stanley from Kiss came in. But
Nicky Hopkins.
Huh?
Nicky Hopkins, great keyboard player.
Yeah.
Victor Feldman.
But if you look carefully in the Flower People, you'll see the drummer there was Russ Kunkel, who was a great drummer, played for, Linda Ronstadt and Jackson Browne and all these great players.
James Taylor.
Yeah, James Taylor. So he's there, but you can't really even notice him in there. And Danny Korshmark is in the Give Me Some Money.
Ed Begley Jr. is the drummer in...
Yes, Ed Begley Jr. Stumpy. So I'm going to ask you, if there's anybody who has a question, you can just shout it out. And we won't answer it, but
are there any microphones out there, or is it just a shouting thing? Well, that's too loud.
But it was an Iron Maiden question, so
what did he say? What did he say?
Was it based on Iron Maiden?
No, it was not based on any particular band. There were elements, the rhythm of the name Spinal Tap always sounded like Uriah Heep or others with that kind of rhythm to it. But we picked and chose from various places.
It was an amalgam. It was an amalgam, and there was life and art kept mirroring each other. I mean, we have that scene where he's backstage, he's trying to get the sandwich to fit on the bread. And that was taken from an article we had read in Rolling Stone called The Endless Party about Van Halen, and they only wanted brown. They wanted all the brown M&Ms removed from the backstage. So we had that, and then there was a keyboard player we had, a guy named John Sinclair, and he was in the 20, I think he was in the 20-minute version that we did. We did a 20-minute demo version to try to get it set up. And then when we were ready to shoot the film, he got a job. He got a job with a real band called Uriah Heep. And they were on tour with an album called Abominog. And he figured, now that's a real band, so I'm not going to go with these schmucks. I'm going to get some real money. So in the middle of the tour, he comes back and tells us about how they got booked into an army base. And we put that right in the film,
And just before we started shooting, I had the opportunity to be in England. I don't even know how I managed to wrangle this, but I got on the road with a band, mid-level. Most Americans haven't heard of it, nor had I at the time. But they had about as much success as Spinal Tap had over the years. English hard rock band called Saxon.
Wow, a lot of Saxon fans out there.
Wow, Saxon fans. Where were you all?
Boy, Saxon could have a reemergence.
Yeah, Saxon reunion just after this. And so I went on the road with them, and I just picked up little details, like the bass player had figured out they were playing basically as we did in E and A, almost all the songs, so he could play basically open strings. He never had to finger, so he could just do this all the time.
My favorite story, I mean, we had all kinds of, life imitating art back and forth, but my favorite thing was that, we had this idea with the Stonehenge, and the film came out, Black Sabbath decided they were touring with a Stonehenge theme, and the film came out literally a week after they started going on tour, and they were furious at us. They said, you stole it. It takes a little bit more than a week to make a film and cut it and then distribute it, but they were sure that we had stolen that idea.
Somebody else want to yell a question?
I'll tell you, the movie reason is that it needed that off.
Let's repeat the question, Bert.
Okay.
Why why the cucumber was wrapped in tinfoil to make the metal detector.
The alarm off.
No. There's another one over there.
There's a good answer to your question.
Okay, we've got two. Any more?
Wait.
We got two cucumbers. I see three.
Okay, the real answer is, and I'm going to invite you to check this out after the show and see if I'm right.
No, don't do that. All right.
If you slip a cucumber, or as I did a zucchini, in your trousers, get up on stage and sweat for 2 hours, you'll be glad it's wrapped in aluminum foil.
The notion of the aluminum foil setting off the airplane alarm, actually, when we first started talking about, there was a film director who tried to sneak a couple ounces of coke on his person, and he wrapped it in aluminum foil.
And a point guard for the Portland Trailblazers, after our film came out, wrapped about an ounce of weed in aluminum foil and tried to get through an airport that way.
Genius.
Yes.
Wow, thank you.
We were doing British accents?
Yes. This guy's father was British.
She said
so he came by it naturally.
She said we guys did British accents better than she'd ever heard on TV in movies.
Including the British.
Well, we spent a lot of time just echoing what Chris sounded like, you know, while we were doing it, because he was on the money all the time. So.
His father was in the House of Lords, and when he passed away, it was handed down to Chris. So Chris became a member of the House of Lords. And what did you pass any significant legislation? Did you?
Well, I was the one who said you don't have to wrap it in foil when you go into the airport. And it didn't go anywhere. The bill went nowhere.
It was advisory more than legislation.
It was a show and tell thing, but it didn't pass.
So you did try to make a contribution.
I did.
Yeah. Why did they kick you out, by the way?
I'll tell you later.
Yeah. Wait, you're going to be next.
Okay. You have to be louder. Go.
Cutting the subplot with the cold sore.
Okay, I'm going to tell you the story. He asked what's the subplot when you see both of them have the cold sores, the herpes sores. That was the remnants of a joke that took about a half hour of film time to set up. At one point, the band was the opening act was a punk band called The Dose, and it was fronted by Sherry Curie, who was in The Runaways. And at one point, she is with Nigel, and they're having a little fling. And the next scene, you see Nigel's got a little herpes sore. And then she's hanging out with David. And then the next scene, he has a herpes sore. And then he's with Derek, and then Derek has a herpes sore. And then there's a scene where the five band members are sitting around deciding, they're thinking about dropping the Dose from the tour. Four guys with herpes sores, and the drummer doesn't have a herpes sore, and everybody's voting to get rid of them, except the drummer says, I think we should keep them. I like them. That was the whole setup, and we wound up with two guys with herpes sores, and that's how that happened. And it's still got a laugh.
Somebody back here, you had a question.
Yeah, what was your favorite thing that didn't make it into the
okay. I like the scene where Lawrence is—he's in the desert. He's
that's Lawrence of Arabia. We're talking about Spinal Tap, because
Yeah, that's my call too. I think
Bruno Kirby singing. He's
yeah.
It's on a DVD extra. You probably saw it. He's at a party with us, and it's late in the evening. Weed and other things have been ingested, and he's stripped down to his skivvies. And he's singing like Frank Sinatra into what he thinks is a microphone, but it's actually a slice of pizza.
Yeah. And then he goes out like a light. Oh man, it was so good. I also kind of, and I understand why they cut it. There was a moment when you remember this is to welcome the touring company of The Wiz and Spinal Tap at the Holiday Inn. We shot a scene where we get on an elevator, and there are two extremely flamboyant Black dancers in their men. And they just kind of give us the eye, and our reactions got a little big, I think. So we cut that, but it made me laugh. I don't know.
The first cut was about 7 hours. We had about 3 hours of interview footage and about 4 hours of, and then you just, and it was a process. It was like making a documentary. We took all that film, and the four of us, it was like writing a movie with the pieces of film. That's kind of what we did.
And occasionally something magical would happen, like we happened to have that shot we talked about.
Oh, God, that
was the explosion of Mick Shrimpton. It's kind of an illusion. It's made of, well, the universe.
Yeah, it was something that we just lucked out in the cutting room it was a very fortuitous thing. We didn't really, the pyrotechnic explosion doesn't happen to Mick Shrimpton. What happens is we cut from Mick Shrimpton to a shot of this explosion which was on the other side of the cut, which is in Japan. And when the dust settles, you see the other drummer there. And it was not anything we planned, but when we saw it, we went, oh, that's how that guy gets it. That's how we lost that drummer. Yeah. You know something? We're going to stop because there's so much that you're going to want to see. Unless you guys, do you want to say a last thing or whatever?
One more question.
One more question, okay.
But let's make it the same question.
What's that? Here. Whatever happened to Viv? Studio album?
All good questions. Thank you. Anyone else?
That was a good idea, Chris.
Yeah. Well, there's no way we're going to be able to tell you everything, but thank you for coming and
yeah, thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stay in your seats. The musical portion of this evening will continue in just a few moments.